G'day, I'm Philip Adams. Almost had you. And you'll get your program of choice in just a moment. This is just me, Jonathan Green, saying you might also like the Sunday Extra podcast. We're on the RN website too.
Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. DNA evidence has helped solve countless serious crimes. But whose DNA material should we put on a police database? Should it only contain samples from convicted criminals? Or should you and I and everybody else donate our genetic fingerprint? We'll hear what the US Supreme Court thinks later in the program. But first to the extraordinary case of a high roller gambler.
The High Court has ruled Crown Casino did not victimise a gambling addict who lost $20 million at its tables.
Harry Kakavas asked the High Court to find Crown responsible for his losses because he said they were aware he was a problem gambler and yet offered him incentives, including the use of a private jet.
The amazing larger-than-life case of Kakavas and Crown Casino. To discuss last week's ruling, I'm speaking with Jamie Nettleton. He's a partner with Addison's Lawyers in Sydney and he specialises in gambling law. And I'm also joined by Melbourne barrister James McIntyre. He's a former senior solicitor with the Victorian Commission for Gambling and Liquor Regulation. James McIntyre, if I can start with you, who is Harry Kakavas?
Harry Kakavas was a gentleman who gambled in large amounts with Crown over a period of time. He had a pretty high turnover of about $1.5 million, which by anyone's standards is a lot of money.
That was in about a 12-month period,
wasn't
it?
That's correct. He was based on the Gold Coast. He was presumably a successful property developer who flew to Melbourne on occasions to gamble at Crown. He was provided with a number of incentives for him to gamble at Crown, such as a private jet on numerous occasions. And I dare say he was one of Crown's most valued patrons.
I understand that he would receive free luxury accommodation. There would be gift boxes full of cash. There was a line of credit of up to $1.5 million. Is that sort of standard for high rollers?
I presume so. I mean, you know, I guess I can't say definitively, but certainly casinos will do what they can to try and get people in, particularly people with a lot of money. It's those sorts of people that feed their business.
Now, Jamie Nettleton, Harry Kakavas is a man with a complex history, isn't he? For a number of reasons, he had been excluded from casinos at various points, hadn't he?
That's correct, Damien. He has had a long history in gambling. He's obviously has participated in a number of casinos, not just at Star City in Sydney, now the Star. He's also participated in casinos abroad in Las Vegas and also in the Caribbean. And he is no stranger to being involved in legal proceedings involving casinos.
What sorts of legal proceedings had he been involved with?
His main concern is to recover losses as a result of his gambling behaviour, and one involved Paradise, which is a casino in the Caribbean, in which there had been a claim brought against him. There's also, obviously, a long history in respect to the proceedings involving Crown Casino in Melbourne, and there's been a number of actions by casinos regulators involving his gambling behaviour.
Let's concentrate on Harry Kakavas's action against Crown. What was the basis of his legal action? Jamie Nettleton.
The initial basis of his legal claim against Crown was brought in negligence. That changed over time, where it was much more focused on a claim for unconscionable conduct under the Trade Practices Act, which, of course, is now part of the Australian consumer law. But it was initially for negligence and in initial decision brought in the Supreme Court before Mr. Justice Harper.
Now, to clarify, so the negligence claim was looking at the way that Crown acted towards him, and over time that kind of changed when that proved to be unsuccessful to more of a trade practices idea about he was a vulnerable person and therefore whatever Crown did, they were unconscionable towards him. Is that the distinction?
Yes, that's right. There's a sort of a multi-layered arguments in connection with the unconscionable conduct claim which came before the High Court. I think perhaps before we move on to that, Damien, we should just focus on the negligence claim because I think it's telling and will always be considered as a cause of action by people who are involved in gambling and suffer losses as a result, and they'll be looking at a panoply of legal rights that they have available to them. And the first one would be involved in negligence. Now, in the context of Mr. Kakavas, he alleged that Crown had breached their duty of care to prevent him from gambling, partly because of their knowledge that he was a problem gambler. But he failed in that cause of action in the Supreme Court.
And so he failed in the Supreme Court. He went on to the Court of Appeal here in Victoria. That was unsuccessful. And then he went on to the High Court. James McIntyre, what is this notion of unconscionable behaviour? And why was Crown not found to have engaged in unconscionable behaviour?
By and large, what the High Court appears to have said is that it came down largely to how he presented himself to Crown. And he presented himself to Crown as a person who not only enjoyed gambling, but could afford to gamble and could afford to gamble and lose large sums of money. On numerous occasions when he gambled at Crown, he deposited front money, and by front money I mean an initial deposit to support his gambling on a particular trip.
So we're talking hundreds of thousands
of dollars. We're talking on many occasions about $1 million, sometimes a little bit less, sometimes more. So what the High Court's saying from Crown's point of view, the way he presented himself to them was simply that he was someone who could afford to gamble and could afford to lose substantial sums of money.
And indeed, he'd go for months at a time without entering the casino. So it wasn't like he was there every single night of the week.
That's correct.
Now, Jamie Nettleton, you point out that he was also gambling at lots of other casinos around the world. So I understand that when he was deciding which casino to attend, he would skillfully negotiate with Crown and other casinos to secure some of the perks we were talking about earlier.
Damien, he certainly did. Crown became aware of the activity which he'd engaged in with Las Vegas, and his reputation essentially preceded him. But as a result of very lengthy discussions between Crown and Mr. Cagwas, in which he made a number of demands about the benefits that should be conferred on him as being a large gambler, almost a whale, that I think it's important to note this wasn't something which happened. You know, he knocked on the door of Crown Casino and started gambling immediately. It took many months before he was allowed to gamble with Crown as a result of these extensive discussions, as a result of a number of reviews that were conducted by Crown as to his ability to gamble in a knowing sense. And they even went to the stage of getting third parties involved to support his return to the gambling floor.
Reports from psychologists and the like.
That's correct.
After this 12-month period where he lost something like $20 million, he decided to sue Crown. And at the High Court level, it was around this idea of unconscionable behaviour. Now, to show this, you need to show you have a special disadvantage that affects your ability to make rational judgments. At the end of the day, is this what, about a quality of bargaining power? James McIntyre.
Certainly that's what the High Court says. One important factor is whether or not one person can be identified as having a special disadvantage, that whether that be some sort of condition which affects their ability to negotiate or their ability to enter into a contract.
Well, we're talking about what? People who are very young, very old, maybe intellectually disabled, maybe adversely affected by drugs or alcohol?
Intoxicated, absolutely. All these classic examples of people that might exhibit a special disadvantage. The next question is whether or not Crown or whoever it might be has preyed upon that special disadvantage to advance their own commercial interests. In this particular case, the High Court didn't find evidence of that, and that was one of the key reasons why the case was dismissed.
So
I think on that one, Damien, the way I read the decision of the High Court in the context of the unconscionable conduct is that there seems to be more premeditated behaviour on the part of a venue, gambling venue like Crown in this instance. The words used by the High Court go as strong as victimisation or predatory behaviour of some sense as being an element which, if found, would assist in the finding of unconscionable conduct. And clearly, as a result of the evidence that was before the courts, that was not found to exist here.
And Jamie Nettleton, what did the court have to say about the nature of gambling in the first place? I mean, it said something along the lines of this is an unusual industry where you are actually trying to do harm to the person you're dealing with.
Yes, it's very interesting statements by the High Court suggesting it's almost like combat, where each party is involved, both the gambler and the venue, essentially trying to win against the other. Now, they don't go quite the stage of saying it's a fierce battle where the last man living, but it does suggest that there is, at the start of a visit that takes place by gamblers, particularly of the nature and scale of Mr. Cagwas, it's very much a matter of trying to win against the other and succeed by taking a very substantial sums of money, at least in the context of a visitor like Mr. Cagwas.
So the High Court has closed the door on Harry Cagwas, and this is the only case of its kind in Australia. Jamie Nettleton, do you know, have there been any other cases in any other parts of the world? And have they been successful?
There, in fact, has been one case in Sydney some years ago, which involved a claim under the predecessor of the unconscionable conduct provisions involving a gambler where essentially he was given information by a hotelier about getting cash advances on his credit card, and it was against the terms of use of the credit card, but notwithstanding that, he took cash advances used for gambling, and according to court, that was known on the part of the hotelier, and the decision of the court in that context was that the gambler was entitled to recover money. So we do have, yes, it was a lower court, but it was a decision made involving American Express card. And that is one case where there's been findings. So far as cases overseas, to be honest, they're few and far between. There was a case involving Calvert and William Hill in the United Kingdom. William Hill's a very well-known bookmaker, which has essentially just entered the Australian market. And in that context, Calvert, again, made extensive bets with William Hill, lost substantial sums of money, and even though it was found that he had a prima facie case involving negligence, the damages which he suffered were unable to be recovered, partly because the evidence was, well, if he hadn't lost them with William Hill, he would have gambled somewhere else and lost the monies with another party. So as a result, he really, in all intents and purposes, failed in his action. So what is actually surprising is that the trend generally is that gamblers have great difficulties in recovering monies against gambling operators of any kind. But I think we need to come back to the fact, I'm sure that James will agree with me on this, that the High Court has left the door open with the possibility that claims may be brought, whether it's in negligence or in unconscionable conduct, providing certain facts are established. But the bar is very, very high.
There was some mention of if a plaintiff came before the court and they were a vulnerable widowed pensioner, something along those lines, then they might have the possibility of success. James McIntyre?
I think that this particular case, because of the high turnover and because of the high amount of losses, it distinguishes it from the average punter, I suppose. The average punter being someone that gambles, that can't afford to gamble and maybe placing their mortgage at risk. And as Jamie said, I do think that it leaves the door open for a negligence claim, and it certainly hasn't closed that door.
At the end of the day, Harry Kakavas was found to be a very, very high-functioning person. He was somebody who was successful professionally, personally, in a familial sense, everywhere. And even though clearly he had a kind of a sort of a pathological interest in gambling, that wasn't enough to show the court that he was somebody with a special need or a special disadvantage when it came to his relationship with the casino.
That's right. Certainly, there's no question that Harry Kakavas was a man who enjoyed gambling. He may have even been a person who did have a certain pathological urge to gamble, but it comes down to whether Crown knew about that and whether they ought to have known about that in the circumstances. Simply put, there was no evidence of that in this particular case, and there was no evidence that they took advantage of it.
A final question to you both. Would you put money on a similar case ever being successful in an Australian court? Jamie Nettleton.
Involving a high roller like Kakavas, no. Involving a widow who's taken advantage of, quite possibly, but I think you have to ask the practical question here as to essentially how would that case be brought, and I've got no doubt that most venues or gambling businesses on the basis of Kakavas and Crown would take it to extreme levels to defend such a claim. So would it get to the High Court? That's a long way for most claims involving widows or widowers to get to.
James McIntyre?
To use a gambling cliche, it might be a 50-1 shot. I wouldn't put it as odds on favourite to win. But certainly, I think the door's open. We may see another case in the future. We may not. Certainly, this negligence aspect remains alive and it'll be interesting to see how it pans out in the future, I think.
James McIntyre, Melbourne barrister, and Jamie Nettleton, partner with Addison's Lawyers in Sydney. Thank you both for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
Thank you, Damien.
Yes, I'm Damien Carrick and you're listening to The Law Report, broadcast each week on RN, ABC News Radio and Radio Australia. Now to DNA profiling and a very important decision last week from the US Supreme Court, the case of King versus the State of Maryland.
The Supreme Court today found police can collect DNA from people they arrest, equating the procedure to standard practices such as fingerprinting.
In April 2009, Alonzo King menaced a group of people with a shotgun. He was arrested and charged with assault. And as a routine part of that booking procedure, a DNA sample was taken from him. When it was run through the database, King's sample matched with a DNA sample found at the scene of an unsolved rape. Alonzo King was ultimately convicted of that crime. But King appealed the conviction, arguing that his DNA sample should never have been taken, that the original DNA test was in fact a breach of his rights under the US Constitution. Here's Associate Professor Jeremy Gans from Melbourne Law School.
Well, under the Fourth Amendment, every American has a right against unreasonable search and seizures without a warrant on probable cause. There was no warrant on probable cause in his case because they had no reason to take the DNA from him at all. They had no idea he might have had a rape in his past. And so he said, I shouldn't have been told to open my mouth, I shouldn't have been told to be swabbed, and the DNA should now be thrown out, and my charge should be thrown out.
And this went all the way through the US legal system, all the way to the US Supreme Court. The court split. What did the majority find?
Well, the majority, and it was a 5-4 split, found that it is reasonable to take someone's DNA on arrest, at least when they're arrested for a serious charge in the US and legislation allows it. Their argument was that the reason you need to take DNA, or it's okay to take DNA from people who are arrested, is because for a set of reasons, the state needs to know who their arrestee is. They need to know what to write down in his file. They need to know how to manage him when he's in detention. They need to know how to decide whether to give him bail or not, and they need to know how to manage him if he's on bail.
One of the things they said was this Fourth Amendment is about intrusive searches, and really putting a cotton bud in somebody's mouth and rubbing it against their cheek is not really an invasive search. There was one fascinating case that they talked about, Winston, where it was held that involuntary surgery for somebody under general anaesthetic to recover a bullet, that was deemed to be an unreasonable search. But this is not. This is not a kind of an unwarranted intrusion into somebody's being or body.
That's right. They're not dramatically cutting open someone's skin. Some DNA sampling procedures might involve a little blood prick, but as long as the person cooperates, you don't even have to do that. You just get a little swab and swab it inside their mouth. They can do it themselves.
So balancing this right to privacy and autonomy and freedom from search, they weighed that up against what? The public's interest, the state's interest in solving crime?
Well, they mainly focused on the state's interest in managing an arrestee and making sure he's not a flight risk. For example, they said that the problem with someone who's under arrest is that they might end up convicted. And nowadays, every major jurisdiction in the world takes people's DNA when they're convicted. If someone like Alonzo King, who the state argues knew he had an unsolved rape in his past, knew that once he was convicted he was going to be found out for this rape, then he has every reason to fly, to run away. And in fact, the majority said that one further reason why it's okay to take the DNA of people on arrest, at least for serious crimes, is because if you do detect an unsolved crime in their past, that might be a crime that someone else has been wrongly convicted for. So it would have the side effect of freeing that wrongly convicted person from prison. And of course, there have been a number of cases in the US where DNA has revealed a wrongful conviction. And such is the stance of prosecutors in the US, even when the DNA they thought was going to match the person convicted turns out not to be a match, the prosecutors continue to fight releasing that person until someone else is identified as the correct offender.
So this was a majority decision which said that taking the DNA sample from Alonzo King was okay. What did the minority find?
Well, everyone's used to 5-4 decisions in the US because there are 4 or 5 conservatives and 4 liberals in the swing vote. But oddly enough, the 4 in the minority here were 3 liberals plus one of the most conservative judges, Justice Scalia, and he wrote the minority judgment. And he poured scorn on the argument that it's worth taking DNA from arrestees to manage whether they're a flight risk or not. He said that everyone knows why you actually take DNA from arrestees. It's just because you want to solve as many crimes as possible. And if they could take DNA from everyone, they would. He said there's no managing a flight risk because it took 4 months to detect Alonzo King's link to the rape. And that's 4 months in which if he'd been released, which he wasn't, he could have got away. And so he said that this was an argument, his words were, that stretches the credulity of the credulous. And he said this was just an easy case where the police asked Alonzo King to do something without a warrant, unreasonably, without probable cause. He said it was exactly the kind of thing the Fourth Amendment was designed to stop. And he pointed out that 200 years ago, it's not as if the founding fathers of the US would have all nodded their heads in agreement, the idea that everyone who's arrested has to open up their mouths for inspection by the state or by the king or whatever.
There was reference to the governor of Maryland saying, I want this case to win because it'll make it clear that DNA testing designed to solve unsolved crimes is okay. So even though the majority was saying one thing about flight risk and what have you, everybody really knew that the issue at stake here was helping the state solve unsolved crimes.
That's right. And the state, when it turned up in the court, just gave the court a list of crimes that have been solved because of this process, and also, even more disturbingly, a list of crimes that could have been prevented had this process been in place in the past. And so that was their main argument, although, as Justice Scalia said, sure, but if we allowed the police to wander into every person's home in the US and just have a look around whenever they felt like it, we'd solve lots of crimes as well. That's why we have the Fourth Amendment, to put a stop to that kind of thing.
There was a quote saying, today's judgment will be sure to have a beneficial effect on solving more crimes. Then again, so would taking of DNA samples from everyone who flies on an aeroplane or applies for a driver's license or attends a public school. And I guess what they're saying is, where do you draw the line?
Well, that's right. And the argument would be that it's worth knowing if a person on your aircraft is someone who's committed an unsolved crime. On the other hand, boarding an aircraft is not a step along the way to being convicted of a crime like arrest is, and that's why the majority focused on the inevitable discovery of someone once they're arrested, assuming they get convicted, of their past crimes. The twist, of course, is that Alonzo King, although he was arrested for first-degree assault, ended up plea bargaining to second-degree assault, and that charge doesn't lead to him having his DNA taken. So he wouldn't have been discovered, although perhaps it's possible that had the police not known about the rape link, they might have pushed it a little harder on that plea bargain.
Jeremy Gans, what about here in Australia? How does the system work here?
Well, we don't have a Fourth Amendment here, so Parliament gets to decide whose DNA is taken and how it's used. And we have a lot of different jurisdictions in Australia. The majority of jurisdictions in Australia have just a system for taking DNA when people are convicted. And the only other people who get their DNA taken in most of Australia, including Victoria and New South Wales, is people who need their DNA taken to investigate the crime for which they've been arrested. So, for example, if they've been charged with a rape and there's something to compare, they can have their DNA taken. All those people, once they have their DNA taken, their DNA will go onto the whole database. And so the police will then learn of any unsolved crimes that they're linked to on the database. And even if that person's never charged, that can happen, but their DNA has to be removed from the database after a year. On the other hand, there are some jurisdictions in Australia which go further along the US path. So the Northern Territory and Queensland both allow DNA to be taken automatically on arrest for sufficiently serious crimes. That DNA goes on the database, and in the Northern Territory's case, it stays there forever, even if the person is cleared of the charge they are arrested for. Western Australia has a narrower system which allows DNA to be taken once you're charged with an offence. Arrest isn't enough. The broadest jurisdiction, as far as I'm aware of in the world, is South Australia, which says that everyone who's even suspected of a sufficiently serious crime, a crime punishable by imprisonment, can have their DNA taken and never given back. It stays on the database and is compared to unsolved crimes for the rest of their life, even if they're instantly cleared of the crime they are suspected of.
Now, that legislation, I understand, came about because of a very controversial court decision in South Australia. Tell me about that case, Dean's case.
Well, South Australia used to follow the same approach which is followed in most of Australia, where DNA is only taken from someone who, to investigate a particular offence, and it gets removed from the database if they aren't convicted within a year. The problem that happened in South Australia is that although they had that law in place, the managers of the database didn't comply with it. They weren't removing people's DNA within a year. And so one person was charged with an assault in a family context, and his DNA was taken to investigate that, but actually the charges were dropped, and it's not known why they were dropped. And over a year later, his DNA was still on the database, and it got linked to a robbery.
A robbery of a supermarket, I think.
That's right. It was an aggravated robbery, so a serious crime. But the problem was his DNA shouldn't have been on the database at all. He should have been treated exactly like most people and not had his DNA on the database. And so that should have been a crime that was solved, if at all, by regular means. Instead, they solved it because they didn't comply with their own law. And so when he came to be prosecuted for that robbery of the supermarket, He said, it's illegal to prosecute me. That evidence should be thrown out, and the judge agreed. And so he got off that charge on what some people can consider a technicality, but nevertheless, it was because South Australia failed to comply with their own rules.
And so, subsequent to that decision, South Australia introduced this incredibly broad legislation.
That's right. They switched to a rule where once you're suspected of your crime, the DNA is taken for any reason or without reason, and it stays on the database forever. And in fact, a similar pattern has happened in other jurisdictions. In Victoria, there used to be a rule that you couldn't have your DNA forcefully taken from you on suspicion of a crime without a magistrate approving it. But a magistrate said no once, and the Victorian Parliament raced through legislation saying, actually, a police officer's say-so is good enough.
Jeremy Gans, what do you reckon? We're dealing with some pretty fundamental issues here around, on the one hand, using whatever we can to solve very, very serious crimes. And on the other hand, we've got these civil liberties concerns. Do you reckon that the Americans have it right? Do you reckon that the South Australians have it right? Do you reckon that some of the more cautious jurisdictions strike the right balance?
No, I don't think any of them have it right. I think the problem with the American approach is it gives the police an incentive to arrest people. And I'd rather they didn't have that incentive. And here the incentive is that person looks a bit sus. I'm not sure if they've committed a crime right now, but if I arrest them, I'll be able to run them through the database and who knows what I'll find. The same applies in South Australia, an incentive to suspect people of crimes. And even if they're wrong, they still get the benefit of running them through the database. I think a much better system, a much fairer system, is if the plan is to use DNA to investigate unsolved crimes, and it clearly has uses for that, the better system is to take DNA from everyone.
Everyone?
That's right. I know that's not a popular view, although I'm not the only one who thinks it. But the advantage it has is it's a much fairer system than the current one, where the only people who are subjected to this process are people who just momentarily brush with the criminal justice system. And I don't think there's a big difference between people who are momentarily suspected of crimes or even people who are convicted of crimes. I don't think there's that big of a difference between them and you and me. I think any of us could have skeletons in our closet. Any of us, to the extent any of us are worth investigating at all of us should be investigated in that way. Of course, the problem is it takes a lot of resources to take everyone's DNA.
And I'd imagine there'd be a lot of objections.
Oh, there would be. But at the same time, it gets you past the objection that people make to these sorts of offences, which is that this system targets the usual suspects, people who tend to have brushes with the police, people who get arrested for brandishing guns or whatever the equivalent is in Australia. They're the ones who have the skeletons in their closet looked into, but no one else does. And that can be discriminatory, and it can affect policing practices in a negative way.
But isn't it if you do come into contact with the criminal justice system, then maybe statistically you're more likely to have committed one of those serious crimes?
Well, maybe, but that's what we have the presumption of innocence for. It's one thing to say, hey, you've been convicted of a crime, but people who are suspected of a crime, they might be suspected because someone wrongly accused them. They might be suspected because the police made a mistake. The DNA that's taken from them might clear them of the crime they were suspected for. I don't see those facts as sufficient to treat them differently from anyone else. All those people are presumed innocent until proved guilty, just like the rest of us.
Associate Professor Jeremy Gans from Melbourne Law School. That's the Law Report for this week. Thanks for listening. A big thank you to producer James Patterson and also to audio engineer Brendan O'Neill. To catch up on the show, just visit the Law Report online at abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more law.
Maybe our political journalists should just get off the bus. Is that how we stop the endless horse race reporting, the leadership speculation, the he said, she saids? Or maybe we get the political reporting we deserve. On Sunday Extra, with me, Jonathan Green, we threw that question over to Greg Jericho, Karen Middleton and Professor Sally Young. And we had a cracking edition of Outsiders. You can stream or download the program from the RN website.